Tonight I'll be reading chapter one of my novel in progress titled Magic America. Buckshot and the Blonde Coyote. Memphis Buckshot gives me a little trouble when I tie him to the cross. The wind coming over the corn carries a warning of frost, and I stand for a moment to button my flannel jacket. Patrick's hunting clothes suit the scarecrow well. Surveying my work, I see a few scrawny patches, and I yank some more straw from the bale I've dragged from the barn. The clothes, a red field coat and khaki trousers, are pretty new, but I'm tired of them sitting on the boot scrape in the mudroom, waiting for Patrick to come back and clear himself out of the house completely. My first plan was to name the scarecrow Abner Catfish and post him up in the corn sporting Patrick's waders and fishing gear. But the hooks on the lure vest kept stabbing me, and eventually I left it out on a post by the road for someone to help themselves to. The hunting clothes were next in the pile, and so Memphis Buckshot was born. I think he's more threatening in a deerstalker cap anyway. And I want to get him jammed into the ground behind the vegetable patch before the crows pick off any more of my produce. If I can sell what I've grown, I just might get the periphery fence repaired before winter. On weekends, and days when I don't need to be at the hospital until 5, I spend my time attempting to keep my small farm running. Having grown up in a city, farm life impresses me as a constant surprise of labor. No matter how well I plan or how hard I work, my life here is a hectic, repetitive wrestle with nature. I plant bulbs to sell spring flowers. Squirrels dig up the bulbs. I plant pumpkins and variegated corn for the Halloween trade. Slugs go for the pumpkins, and deer munch the corn right off the stalk. My sunflowers have crows sitting on their heads. There are mice in my kitchen eating the corn muffins and pumpkin bread. Raccoons love it here. They eat nearly everything. Sometimes I think I'm running a buffet for wildlife. My situation is the stuff of nursery rhymes. I need to sell the sunflowers, to pay for the farm stand so I can sell the pumpkins and corn, to buy the fence to keep the deer off the land so I can sell everything else, and fix up the house before it falls down. Giving up has occurred to me, of course. It's not just that farming is hard work. I'm also just not very good at it. I feel sorry for the animals that come and harm the crops. I don't like to use chemicals. I hate the people at the FSA. Some resistance in me to taking advice from any person wearing a string tie. Mostly, though, I still miss Rick. During one spring break, we found Blonde Coyote Ranch while we were out riding. We started making plans, the way college kids do. We'd save up and buy the place, grow our own food, maybe get a few horses so Rick could give riding lessons. We would be free. Never would the pair of us surrender to 9-to-5 slavery. Apart from the obvious heartbreak of grief, the problem when you lose the person you planned to spend your life with is that you're also left without a plan. I think it's pretty normal to want to preserve whatever part of it you can. Buying the farm made it seem like Rick was close for a while, but slowly, almost without my noticing, it's come to feel like every labor I take on has a set of ghost hands tangled up in mine. They don't take up any of the burden. They're just some thin company I can't leave behind. Indian summer lasted long this year, and the animals have prolonged their preparations for the cold months ahead. The farmer's almanac predicts a winter storm in just a few weeks. Rick was a big believer that the animals would show us which way nature was planning to go. And times like now remind me of it. There's a frenzy to their work, a warning. Wearing work gloves is taken as a sign of my tenderfoot roots by my farming neighbors, but the canvas keeps my hands from getting cut up, so I persist. Somewhere inside, I think if my hands don't turn into farm woman hands, I will always be able to leave the rustic life and move into a more genteel world if I choose to. Maybe I'm kidding myself. I can't actually see a way out, but I like to hold on to the belief that maybe a way out might present itself. The wood for the scarecrow post was weighty enough when I dragged it from the barn. And now it's all the heavier for the planks being nailed together with Memphis lash to them. Straightening my gloves, I squat down, grab the crossbeam under Memphis's armpits, and lift with my legs. I take a deep breath and start to drag the post over to where I mean to set it in the ground when I see the squirrel. Fat for winter and thick with fur, his little paws dig furiously around the edge of the screening I laid to protect the bulbs. I drop Memphis, snatching my feet out of the way of the falling weight. The rough beams catch on the canvas fingers of my gloves and pull them off so they flip from my hands and land near Memphis's head like a pair of exhausted fish. Bunches of straw are the only thing to hand, and I grab two and run at the fluffy gray body, waving and yelling something like, "Arg!" The squirrel freezes for a moment, twitching his tail and watching me from his black eye. Then he scrambles. He darts left and then right, and I run for him. I've scared him, but I am determined he should know not to ever come back here. Unable to hurt these invading creatures, I realize nonetheless that I want to traumatize him. I might spend some time later meditating on what this means for a therapist. Right now, I chase after him, waving fistfuls of straw and shouting my made-up anti-squirrel voodoo. While he cuts a series of overlapping geometric shapes around me and I hop up and down and yell, I glimpse a winged shadow on the grass. In a flash, the hawk makes his kill dive, just missing the squirrel I have confused into suicidal exposure. I scream. The squirrel scampers into a nearby tree. With a flap of his brown wings, the hawk lifts to the air, swoops for the tree, and crashes through the leaves. A flurry of banshee branch waving is followed by a moment of silence. My shoulders drop, and the straw I clutch flutters to the ground. Then with a shredding of foliage, the bird hurtles out of the tree, empty-taloned, and plummets toward me. I barely have time to raise my arms in defense when he flies past my head, his wingtip close enough to create a whisper in my ear. I lower my arm just as he passes over Memphis buckshot. My relief is cut short when suddenly, almost as a rude parting gesture, the hawk dives down and grasps my work gloves before lifting up once more to soar off over the corn. I stand open-mouthed for a minute, watching my gloves disappear above the woods, before resigning myself to put one final effort into getting Memphis stuck in the ground. After that, I'll call it a day. Riding a scarecrow is not easy work, and without my gloves, my hands are scratched and splintered by the time I get him stuck into the ground where he belongs. Back on my porch, I work my way into the tire swing that hangs by a rope from an exposed beam. Hugging the tire while the rims cut into the backs of my thighs, I crack open a diet root beer I've grabbed from the old pink Frigidaire in the kitchen. I plan to put up a porch swing, but they cost hundreds, so I'll have to wait for January when they go on sale. I amuse myself with the thought that maybe I'll find a boyfriend I can get along with by then, so I'll have some help hanging it. Old Memphis looks handsome guarding the vegetable patch. I smile at him now, his great long arms cutting a divide in the woods far behind, a lush tree line that will, in a matter of weeks, begin its glorious decay into crimson, burnt amber, and gold. For now, the only color apart from brown and green comes from the fluorescent orange signs that were put up at the start of fall. I can't read them from here, but I know what they say. Hunters in the woods today. An ominous but unpredictable warning that will remain there until the end of hunting season. Theoretically, hunters shouldn't be a worry. Certainly not according to the Division of Fish and Wildlife. No string ties there, but way too many pairs of Birkenstocks. There are designated areas and seasons for game out of which licensed hunters are never meant to stray. The problem is, with the extensive damage to the periphery fence around the north and west sides of my land, hunters not familiar with the area occasionally wander onto my property. You would think the sight of plowed land would clue them in to the fact that they were near the edge of hunting grounds, but I've found men in bright orange jackets halfway down a row of corn, shotguns at a 45-degree angle to the earth, ready to take aim if necessary. I usually tell them off from a safe distance, But the last time I did, one man apologized profusely and then asked if I wouldn't mind getting him a cup of coffee. I was so shocked, I gave him one. And so I met Patrick. I've made up a new rule about not talking to trespassers since then. As it seems to always happen when I'm taking a moment to appreciate a completed task, another presents itself. While I am looking out at my scarecrow, a buck appears at the edge of the wood. In a single bound, he leaps a damaged section of fence. Once on my property, he dips his head to forage in the high grass. Between the broken and missing sections of fence and their powerful ability to jump, deer pretty much have the run of the place. They've eaten most of the low-hanging fruit and some of the ornamental shrubs. Every 6 months or so, I have a Lyme test done to make sure I've not been bitten by one of their ticks. Still, they're magnificent to watch, and once again, displaying my city-bred sentimentality, I'm thrilled when they wander near the house, even though I soon need to frighten them off. I hate to admit it, but my legs are not as flexible as they once were. After a brief struggle to free myself from the tire, during which I kick over a chrysanthemum pot and then proceed to spill Diet A&W across the porch, I right myself, thinking, as I view the mess, that at least ants don't like aspartame. My commotion has not disturbed the deer in his foraging, and as he works his way down a row of corn, I wonder what my chances are of getting closer to him. He is a whitetail, 8-point, elegant and well-muscled. Memphis stands between us, 100 yards or so from him. Slowly, I make my way down the porch steps and begin to move through the garden, taking advantage of the camouflage of sunflowers and pumpkin vines, crawling at times to avoid being seen. The buck is still grazing, unaware of me. I draw near the foot of the scarecrow where the vegetable patch ends. The buck has moved closer, following a trail of food. And when I hide myself behind the tied bunches of straw at the ankles of Patrick's trousers, the animal is 15 feet from me. I stand, still as I can, for several minutes, watching the velvet gray of his antlers, the ripple of his shanks, the white ring around his black wet muzzle nibbling at the stalks. And then, with a crack, Memphis Buckshot's head explodes, sending straw and bits of deerstalker hat into the air. Shocked, I stare into the sky while the buck darts his head up in alarm. There is another crack, and I suddenly realize what is going on. Memphis's chest bursts apart, spraying me with straw, and I dive to the ground. Hunters. The buck springs into motion, leaping across the vegetable patch and around the side of the house. I roll on my back and start to holler. There is a thumping in my arm where I must have hit the scarecrow post when I fell. My heart is pounding. I want whoever is out there to realize there is a person here and not just a scarecrow. I shout as many obscenities as I can think of, and then, for several minutes, I don't hear anything. Deciding it's safe to try to get back to the house, I roll over on my stomach. Feeling like I'm playing G.I. Joe, I crawl along the furrows in the vegetable patch with my elbows in the zucchini. I remember an anecdote once relayed to me about a farmer who, sick of deer hunters shooting his livestock, painted the word cow in 3-foot letters across one of his black and white Holsteins. Somebody shot it. Huddled on my porch steps, I look down to find my hands shaking. I feel sick to my stomach. Meaning to wipe the sweat from my forehead, I roll down my sleeve with trembling fingers. That's when I see the pellet hole. I take the fabric of my jacket between my fingers and pull it taut for a better look. Right above my left elbow is a hole about the size of a pea, with a tear an inch behind it where a pellet of buckshot went straight through my sleeve. There is blood on the tear. My legs wobble beneath me as I stand to go inside the house. I need to remove my jacket and shirt to have a better look. Thick scallops of peeling gray-white paint crumble under my hand as I lean on the clapboards and fiddle with the latch of the screen. Everything I see comes into sharp focus as the possibility of being shot drifts down on me like a falling leaf. I know I have to get inside and force myself to concentrate on what is around me and not the sick feeling in my stomach. After I've wiped my brow again, the storm door gives with a squeal of dry hinge. Dizziness comes over me when I think about my arm. I tell myself there can't be any real damage if I'm walking around, but I know that I am pushing back worse images. I pass the living room with its smoky fireplace that backs into a kitchen last decorated in the 1940s, about which I find myself thinking that at least the pipework is old enough that the sink provides scalding water. My arm feels warm, hot. I don't want to touch it, not yet. I grip the wobbling banister, climb the creaking stairs. This is when it is bad to be alone. This is when it is the worst to know no one is home, that no one will be coming home. No one will find me if I faint. I cannot faint, I tell myself. I reach the top of the stairs. Upstairs are two bedrooms, one of them converted into a bathroom that holds a high-level cistern and a clawfoot tub. The floorboards groan as I make my way to the ceramic sink. I take a deep breath. I will not pass out. I take another breath. Cold wind blows through the warped glass window panes, and I let it cool me as I unbutton my jacket and pull my sweater and t-shirt over my head. The sleeve of the t-shirt is dark with blood. A deep groove cuts across my upper arm, showing where the pellet grazed my skin. Though the shirt is soaked up a good deal, there is blood running down to my elbow. I feel lightheaded and clutch the sink for support, my face pale in the dusky mirror. Then, just as if someone opened a trap door in my feet, it feels as if all the energy rushes out of me. Something in me fails, and I crumple, hitting my cheekbone on the curved rim of the tub as I slump to the floor. Good evening.